Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Solieri Report. Today is December 6, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're joined by my investment advisory colleagues, Chuck Gibson and Melanie Paleo. They join me to talk about your taxes in 2013. To say that our current tax situation is fluid is an understatement. One thing we know, though, that revenues are falling throughout the economy, in most places throughout the economy. Expenses are rising, certainly in nominal dollar form, and that means deficits are greater for government and efforts are underway to raise taxes. So it's a good time to pay attention to what may happen and what it means to you. We're going to have slides tonight on the webinar software, both slides throughout the Solieri Report, and then we have several charts for our presentation, and those charts are up on the blog. You have to log in. It's in the subscriber-only space on tonight's Solieri Report blog post. Just a quick report. We had a subscribers luncheon in Murfreesboro outside of Nashville. Last Saturday, 30 subscribers turned up for a great lunch, a great discussion. We had an interesting roundtable on what were the Solieri reports we could do this year in 2013 coming up that would be the most useful to you, and three that we walked away with that we're working on scheduling now. One is detox programs. Everybody's ready for the cleanse. Self-directed IRAs. What are the more creative things you can do with your IRAs? And then angel networks and local investment. So watch for those in the first and second quarter of this year. Well, the holidays are here. I'm sure you know that. This week we sent out our annual Christmas card. Each year we have our wonderful graphics designer and some artists make a new card for us. This year we had Santa's Workshop, except Santa is making the toy of the year in a 3D printer, and that's sort of a nod to the changes in fabrication technology that we've been talking about. We asked all of our subscribers and our full readership to give us suggestions. We always make a donation. This year, 2 years ago, it was all the food banks in the countries and states that we have subscribers. Last year, it was the Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund, Pete Kennedy's wonderful group affiliated with the Weston Price Foundation, and that protects the right of farmers to sell directly to consumers. This year, we got great suggestions. I want to thank you for all of them. And we chose four. We couldn't bring it down to one. So we have Jeffrey Smith, that wonderful Jeffrey Smith, whose efforts to bring transparency and labeling to GMO food are critical. His Institute for Responsible Technology. Then the New Energy Movement, which is an educational organization led by Joel Garbon, that try and promote new energy technologies. And then the wonderful Computers for Everyone in Silicon Valley, led by Court Skinner, great ally. You'll see his posts on the blog. And what he does is recycle, use corporate computers to people who couldn't otherwise afford them. It's a wonderful little not-for-profit outside of San Francisco. And then finally, because of Hurricane Sandy relief, the Community Food Bank of New Jersey. You'll find we sent out the card this week, and we encourage you, of course, at holiday time to remember the not-for-profits and good works that all these civic organizations do. Another holiday treat out tomorrow, we'll be sending it out to you. We know from talking with many of you, both at the luncheons and your feedback throughout the year, that you all have friends and family who you'd like to help think and act strategically. So because January is the month when we do a lot of our Solieri reports to help you plan out your year, the first week we have the annual wrap-up, which is a great overview of the big trends for the year, and then the precious metals market report, and then Chuck Gibson, who's going to be with us tonight, will be back in the third week for the equity overview. So it's a big sort of strategic insight for the year. So what we thought we'd do is send to each subscriber the opportunity to gift a one-month subscription and get all that content to a family and friend, anyone you love. And so we'll be sending that out tomorrow. And if you will just send us the information, we'll make sure that they have a one-month subscription that gives them access, thanks to you, complimentary to you at no charge, to all of that for the first month of the year. And we think it's a great way to help someone you love understand the important trends that are going to impact their lives and finances in 2013. Our theme tonight is, and take a look at the slide, it's a great one, Rush Hour Cometh. The federal budget has become a major part of corporate revenues, municipal revenues, household incomes, and expenses in the United States. So a big part of our economy runs through the federal budget. In the 1990s, we bubbled the economy. We issued a great deal of debt, as we all know, and it expanded, among other things, not only government debt, but government overhead. Now, as we did it, we moved a significant amount of capital and business abroad. We also, following it, moved a significant amount of military, and that resulted in a lot of income moving abroad and ultimately falling incomes to American households, and now, of course, eventually to government. What goes around comes around. So in the meantime, central banks have increased the money supply, and the federal government is engaged in more deficit financing. So to help service the growing debt, we're watching the value of our currency erode. And what that means is each one of us is experiencing expenses in nominal terms. So our food budget is going up. The cost of gas is going up. We've talked on the Solari report a lot about the debasement of the currency and how that drives up your nominal expenses. So we have falling incomes and rising expenses, and that's both households and governments. So now the federal government is saying they need greater tax collections to reduce their deficit. Now, as you can imagine, the politics of this are extremely sensitive, and negotiations have been very fluid. And the U.S. government is facing a whole series of expiring dates that have been part of kick the cans in a variety of ways over recent years. So at the end of this year, the Bush tax cuts will expire. If spending's not adjusted, there are automatic cuts that will happen to government spending as well. And on top of that, the debt limit must be increased if the federal government can continue to borrow money. All of this coming to the head at the same time at the end of this year is what Ben Bernanke, chairman of the Federal Reserve, earlier this year termed the fiscal cliff. However, there's a much deeper issue, and that is that the federal government has been consuming and controlling a steadily increasing share of the economy, and that, along with numerous other things, is really causing a shrinkage of productivity in the economy. Now, tonight, we're going to talk about the nuts and bolts about what could happen to individual taxes at the end of this year and in 2013. In my annual wrap-up in early January, I'm going to talk more about the deeper questions of how to re-engineer the federal budget and how to do it in a way that reflects the fact that we're now experiencing not just another economic cycle or a recession or depression, but really a fundamental re-engineering of institutions and markets. And of course, that's going to be an ongoing topic throughout next year, as it has been for a long time, on the Solari report. But the bottom line is we've kicked the can on the federal budget about as far as it can go, and so now rush hour cometh. Money and markets, of course, the top story is the fiscal cliff negotiations. Very surprisingly, the administration has put Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner in charge of the negotiations. And this is unusual because Geithner has announced he's leaving in January. So in one sense, he's a lame duck. And he's also not somebody who has a very good relationship with Congress. Given the fluidity of cabinet members, we're looking at a very fluid situation because not only are the policies up for grabs, but a lot of the people who are running them now are going to run them are, you know, planning on leaving. So you have a very fluid set of policies, a very fluid set of players, and numerous highly sensitive, controversial issues. So we're watching something that is more fluid than you like to see around this much money and power. The debt limit is a particularly sensitive issue. The approvals of how much money the government can borrow are often done separate to the appropriation process. And you'll see these situations where we bump up into the debt limit. A variety of people use it as a toll booth to get their way on other issues, and you can end up in a real dogfight. One of the most desperate times in recent memory was this happened in 1995. And it was one of the reasons at the time that everybody told me, that's it, we've given up on democracy, we're pulling all the money out of the country. Because the process of trying to get people to agree to a fiscally responsible solution has always proved to be very elusive, particularly if you can just go borrow money. Some of the key issues that we'll be talking about tonight but are on the table in the negotiation is the Democrats want an increase in the top tax rates. For individuals, the Republicans are saying no. The Republicans are insisting on cuts in entitlements. The Democrats were saying no until today, when a new twist, two of the top Senate Democratic leaders, Durbin of Illinois and Chuck Schumer from New York, signaled that they may have to accept cuts to U.S. entitlement programs to secure deficit reduction. The real big problem in that equation, of course, is Medicare. We've been talking about on the Salyer Report. Several videos from Carl Denninger I posted in the blog in recent weeks where he talks about at the current rate of growth in Medicare, within some reasonable period of time, it will be bigger than the entire GNP of the country. Obviously, that can't continue. We have an article on the blog, CEO groups insisting on cutting entitlements. And the amazing thing about this is here you've got guys who've received billions of dollars off budget in bailouts, insisting that we have to cut entitlements that are on budget. You know, if there was no hypocrisy in this world, they'd be suggesting we move the entitlements off budget as well. Stepping in to support this, Federal Reserve is meeting next week on December 11th and 12th and is expected to announce more monthly bond purchases, part of the QE3. But in combination with other planned bond purchases, we're looking at possibly another $85 billion of treasuries and mortgage-backed securities, which should provide significant liquidity to the market. And when you add that to the low interest rates near zero, it's quite an injection. The Fed could even decide to do more in theory. They certainly have the authority to do it. A new announcement, pretty terrifying, and I want to make sure that anybody, any young people or people with children, grandchildren headed for college, take note. An announcement this week, it's up on the blog from Bloomberg, that the student loan debt collection is targeted for an overhaul in U.S. legislation next year. They're looking to be able to deduct student loans directly from paychecks. And in combination with a provision of no bankruptcy, it's a frightening combination. And you really want to be extremely careful before at this point you mess with student loans. Better to work and go part-time is my feeling. I think it's a very, very dangerous legal structure and financial structure to put a young person into at a young age. Congress is doing it because the difficulty of collecting in this kind of economy from students who are burdened with debt or ex-students with burned debt is tough. Our hero tonight, we're going to have to share the spotlight between two heroes. Walter Binney is a NSA whistleblower. He was a key source for the recent article in Wired magazine about the NSA data center in Utah. He has done several interviews now on TV throughout this year about the collection by the NSA of data and sort of the invasion on individual privacy. I put it up on the blog in connection with a new Pulp Fiction book that John Rappaport put me onto, a review on the blog called Blacklist. And it's a remarkable, you know, sometimes beach reading is the way to get to walk around inside a world and understand the way that this kind of very invisible technology can impact your life. And so It's a quick read, and it's certainly not great literature, but it will help you get inside of what it feels like to be a target of the kind of technologies that William Binney is talking about. But it took tremendous courage to do what he's done and sort of explain it to the American people. So check out that commentary. Also died this week a wonderful U.S. jazz pianist, Dave Brubeck. We're going to have a Christmas tune from him up on the blog this weekend as we put a video, music video up each weekend, and it seemed very appropriate. It's the first time I've put up jazz Christmas music, but Brubeck is very special. Ask Catherine. A great question in from Jim. Many of the questions are on taxes, so I'm going to be asking Mel or Chuck when we get to the interview. Great question from Jim in San Diego. Major financial institutions are buying foreclosed single-family properties in massive quantities right now. With this in mind, what could be done by the powers that be that could create appreciation in the housing market despite the horrible economy that we're experiencing? Great question, and they're absolutely, you know, it's kind of like the joy of cooking. There are many recipes, but let me just mention a few of the things that the federal government could do that could significantly increase the value of single-family housing once it's been shifted in bulk accumulations. And my guess is watch for bulk sales through Freddie, Fannie, and FHA after January 20th. The first thing is special tax incentives. Another is increased immigration. It's increased immigration was one of the things that supported the housing market, because if you have first-time home buyers coming in, you kind of cascade everybody upwards. A variety of different new energy technology and lower costs of energy could help. Significant increased liquidity of local investment of the kind they're talking with the new crowdfunding provisions. But there's certainly a lot that could be done informally as well to circulate much more investment locally. You could re-engineer the federal budget in a variety of ways, including making provisions that make rental housing much more attractive than it is relative to home ownership. And finally, they have the power to swing in major contracts or other outsourcing or facilities back into targeting areas with big real estate positions that create a lot of jobs and income in the general area. So, you know, if you swing at the income after you've taken the position in the real estate, there's extraordinary impact you can have on the capital gains in the real estate. Check out an article from Bloomberg on the blog this week about large accumulations by BlackRock and other hedge funds. It's absolutely happening. We're getting reports from a variety of realtors around the country about watching very significant accumulations in their places. Okay, so let's turn to our interview. Again, let's talk a little bit about goals. It's very important before the end of the year, if there are going to be changes in the tax code, and again, we don't know for sure what's going to happen, but if there are going to be possible changes that could impact you, we want to make sure you understand what they are so that you have time before the end of the year to speak with your CPA or tax preparer. If you do your own taxes, take the time to sit down and look at this before the end of the year. We also want to make sure that in your 2013 budget, you have prepared for the fact that there is likely to be additional taxes one way or the other. And so forewarned is a good thing. And that's the goal tonight, to give you the background you need to sit down and then take some time to look at your unique situation and see what, if anything, you can do to make sure you're prepared for what's going to come. And again, I just want to say that each person listening tonight has their own unique situation. So we're going to be speaking generically, but before you take action or assume something's true, you really do need to consult with an expert that understands your unique situation. So joining me tonight is Chuck Gibson, who's not a stranger on the Solari Report. We did a great equity overview recently. And then before that, we did a view from Silicon Valley overview, a sort of a review of the technology trends that we expect to impact the equity markets. The next equity overview is coming up on January 18th, and that's one you don't want to miss. Chuck's the president of Financial Perspectives, and he's my partner and fellow managing member of C-Lane Advisory. And also joining us is our powerhouse, Melanie Paleo. She works with Chuck as a certified financial planner and manages the C-Lane Investment Committee for us. She's also licensed as an enrolled agent but doesn't practice. Melanie, I'm just going to tease her now, happens to be very smart. And from my point of view, I'm always teasing her about her near encyclopedia capacity for remembering the complexities of financial planning, which is one of the reasons I was delighted when she and Chuck said that they would join me this evening. So let me just note that we're also going to be covering a fair amount of ground tonight, and I'm going to take extra time because it's important that we, that we not race too much and go into the details where appropriate. So Chuck and Melanie, are you with us?
I am. Good evening, Catherine.
Good evening.
Hi, Catherine. It's Melanie. Good evening.
Hi, Melanie. Okay, take it away, Mel. I'm going to start with you. Taxes and the fiscal cliff. Can you give us an overview?
Sure. I'm actually going to be referring to chart one when I start this. So if you guys can take a look at that. When you look at the fiscal cliff, there's actually two elements of the fiscal cliff. There's the tax increases, which is of most concern to most individuals, and then the spending cuts portion of it. And all told, the fiscal cliff's impact would be to decrease the GDP by $650 million, according to the Congressional Budget Office. In absent legislative action, the tax impact uh, in in that is going to be around $500,000, which for households is going to average almost $3,500 each, which is approximately 20% above what they would see without the fiscal cliff going into place.
So you mean $500 billion?
Yes, excuse me, $500 billion.
$500 billion. Okay.
Yes. Sorry, $500 billion. Yes. And you know, absent legislative action, as Catherine mentioned earlier, the most tax cuts that were enacted in the Bush era are going to expire as of January 1st, 2013. And for most households, the two biggest increases are going to be from the expiration of those tax cuts and then also the expiration of a temporary payroll tax cut that's been enacted for the past 2 years.
So just walk us through chart one and show us how big the Bush-era tax cuts are relative to the other possible changes.
Sure. So if you look at chart one, you'll see that in terms of the expiration of the Bush tax cuts, that is supposed to have an impact of $180 billion in terms of decreasing the GDP. And that's coming directly out of workers' or individuals' pockets. And in terms of the Bush-era tax cuts, there's really five areas that we're discussing when you think about that. One that most people are aware of course, is the marginal income tax brackets. For the marginal income tax brackets, what you're going to see is that instead of the current rates, which are at 10% on the low end and 35% at the high end, without any action, those are going to increase by 5% so that it's 15% at the low end and as high as 39.6%. The second of most interest is usually the capital gains tax. And the capital gains tax currently, for anyone who is in the 10% tax bracket, they actually pay no long-term capital gains taxes. And anyone above the 10% marginal rate pays a 15% rate on their long-term capital gains. With no changes occurring in 2013, that will increase to 10% for those in the bottom tax bracket and increase to 20% for those anywhere above. At that point, it would be a 15% tax rate. Next would be the qualified dividends. Currently, qualified dividends are taxed at a 15% rate. And if nothing happens in 2013, those would go back to being taxed at ordinary income tax rates. So they would also be taxed at those higher income tax rates that would be put into effect in 2013. And then finally, also, they're not only going to increase your tax rates, they are also going to reduce some of the deductions that are allowed. So if you itemize deductions, currently there were no caps to that itemized deduction. You can deduct as much as you wanted. But with 2013 coming back will be a cap on certain itemized deductions depending on your adjusted gross income. And then also in that same place, there will be a phase-out that will be implemented for the personal exemption rate.
Right.
And then finally, also within the Bush-era tax cuts, the really big onerous portion is the expiration of the estate tax changes. And with the estate taxes, what you see is, again, you're going to increase the top rate. Currently, it's at 35%. It will go up to 55%. And there is currently an estate tax exemption of a little over $5 million. It's $5.12 million. And if nothing happens, that's going to decrease by $1 million. Decrease to $1 million. So it's actually essentially a decrease of $4 million that you're going to be losing. And also with that, there's something that's called portability, which means that if you are a surviving spouse and your deceased spouse didn't use all of their estate tax exemption, currently, you're able to actually use whatever they didn't use during their estate tax planning or figuring and use that in your total at the end of your life so that, in essence, you could exempt up to $10 million at the end of the second spouse's life. And finally, with the estate tax and the gift tax, they're right now actually a unified tax. So at this point in time, the gift tax exemption is also at $5 million. That would reduce back down to $1 million as well.
Right. So you're looking at higher ordinary income rates than higher rates on capital gains and investment income and higher estate. So it's really, it could hit an individual in a whole number of different places. And particularly could really hurt somebody who's dependent on investment income. Because if I'm, let's just look at a little perspective here. If I've been living on investment income, then I've been watching my yields come down tremendously on my fixed income investment, my purchasing power come down because of the debasement. And some of my capital gains are coming from inflation, not really from real gains. They're nominal gains, but I'm getting taxed on the nominal dollar. So this could be a real squeeze on a lot of individuals. Okay.
Yeah, and this only includes the Bush era tax because we haven't gotten to the rest of this yet. So this is you can see how onerous this could be. It's gonna. I don't know how it's not going to affect virtually everybody in some form or another.
Right. Right. Okay, Mel. Anything else on the Bush tax cuts?
Oh, there was one thing that I did want to mention in terms of the capital gains, because I know a lot of your listeners might own actual tangible assets. And in terms of tangible assets, the capital gains rate has actually not changed on that. It's always been 28%, and it will continue to be 28%. So there hasn't been really any change in that regard.
Right, that we know of.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Anything's possible.
Very true.
But as far as we know, the taxes on precious metals have been onerous, and they're going to continue to be onerous.
Yes.
Okay. And again, if you look at the amount of money in terms of budget, I would say that the Bush tax, the Bush tax cuts are the biggest pot on the table right now of any of the things we're going to discuss. So let's turn to the payroll tax or the expiration of the payroll tax decrease. Maybe if you could introduce that.
Sure. So the expiration of the payroll tax decrease is actually what happened was in 2010, President Obama declared a what we call a holiday on 2% of Social Security payroll tax for the employee. So the employee used to pay 6.2% into the Social Security fund out of their take-home pay. And in 2010, it got decreased to 4.2%. And so absent any extension on that, the Social Security tax that workers will have to pay will go back to 6.2% as of January 1st, 2013. And the impact is an immediate reduction in your take-home pay.
Yeah, so if you want to put that, well, I was going to say, if you wanted to put that in perspective, if the average household takes in $50,000 a year, just that's what we're in and around that area, that means that they're going to have another $1,000 in taxes.
Right. Just from this item.
Just from this specific item. So it's $1,000 in taxes, $1,000 in less take-home pay, and $1,000 towards less living expenses.
Right. Right. Okay, next up is the expiration of the alternative minimum tax patch.
Yes. And so everything that we've talked about so far is actually something that will affect tax year 2013. With the alternative minimum tax patch, this is actually an immediate impact on this current year, 2012's potential tax impact. The alternative minimum tax system was originally created to initially ensure that high-income payers paid some minimum of tax regardless of their deductions and exemptions and credits. And what Congress usually did was institute a patch year over year that would increase the deduction that people could take on figuring out what the alternative minimum tax would be. Because originally it was not indexed to inflation. And so a lot of people that weren't necessarily considered the high-income earners were getting caught in this trap because of some of the deductions that they were able to take on their taxes, and then they had to put back into as preference items in figuring out their alternative minimum tax. So if nothing happens, the current deductions that you're able to take are $74,450 for joint filers and $48,450 for any other filer. And that will be reduced to $45,000 for joint filers and $33,750 for any other type of filer. So it's a huge decrease in terms of the deduction that you can take to figure out the alternative minimum tax.
Go for it.
I was just going to say that I don't know if anybody of your listeners or those that understand it can understand the impact, but this is from a magnitude standpoint, this is the largest, I think, that could hit people that aren't aware of it, because the difference – so, you know, the way the alternative minimum tax works is it's two taxes. Basically, you have to file two sets of taxes, or you calculate two sets of taxes, your normal rates on how they want you to, and then you have to do another calculation, it's a separate calculation for the alternative minimum tax. And whichever is higher, that's what you got to pay. But – okay, so that doesn't sound so bad, but what is bad is that the starting rate on alternative minimum tax, I believe, is 28%, right, Mel?
Yes.
Okay, so if you fall within the alternative minimum tax guidelines and you have, for example, you know, $50,000 of taxable income, if you do it the ordinary way, you might only fall in the 10 or 15% tax bracket. But with the alternative minimum tax, you will now rise to a 28% tax bracket. So you can do the math. That's a minimum of a 13% increase on your taxes on $50,000 or whatever your income is. And it's unbelievably onerous and very surprising if you're not aware of it, because I've gone through that and lived through it. And you think you've planned your taxes really well and you've got everything proportioned appropriately and you're going to, you know, hopefully get a little bit back on your return when you file them, and you find out you owe, in my case, it was tens of thousands of dollars. No, I was going to say that. So people, this is going to, especially because it's going to take effect at the end of this year, people need to be really prepared for this.
So, but it's going to be retroactive.
Yes.
So it will affect your 2012 filing that you is due in April.
Exactly.
Yes. So that means it affects your estimated in January as well.
Yes, it does.
Yes.
Yeah. One of the things that struck me when the three of us went through this the other day, is I almost felt like this was sort of a get California tax, because, you know, I just came back from being out there with all of you in San Francisco area. And I live in Tennessee, which is a state that has no income tax. So I have no deduction. I have no state income tax deduction because I have no state income tax. And I have three properties here in Hickory Valley, and my combined city and county property taxes are $500 a year. Which in San Francisco, you know, I don't think anybody in your area can conceive of property taxes of $500 a year. And so if you're in California and you have, well, think, I mean, I on just one, this one property, I have an, you know, I have a barn, I have orchards, I have a garden, I have acreage, I have a house, I have big trees, you know, whatever. And I've got, you know, and this property alone is $250 for the year. So when it comes to a state with no income tax and very low cost housing compared to a very high cost area like San Francisco, the AMT could, if you have significant state income tax deductions and mortgage deductions, it could be very painful.
Absolutely. In addition to that, and I know this isn't a part of the fiscal cliff but it is a tax issue. Next year, because we voted in for the tax increase for state taxes, our tax rates are going from a top level of 10.3% to 13 plus. So we'll be the most taxed state in the union. So this is in addition to the increases in the federal taxes that we're all talking about here.
Right. Okay, on that cheerful note, Okay, let's go through the additional impacts.
Okay, the additional impacts, and I'm just going to take these in order in terms of their monetary value on the chart. The mandatory spending cuts are those cuts that Catherine referred to in terms of the mandatory cuts that are going to happen if Congress and the President don't agree on an actual spending cut package that is going to pass. And so that's going to be immediate as of January 1st, 2013. The other expiring provisions are a set of tax deductions that are actually more geared towards businesses that are called extenders. And usually what happens is Congress will extend those packages year over year. And most of them, like I said, affect businesses like R&D deductions that are available. And actually for individuals, the biggest thing would actually be for certain credits for education expenses that are currently given to individuals. But if they don't extend them, those are going to go away. The Affordable Care Act, now that is the surtaxes that are going to be hitting people that make $250,000, and there's actually or more. And there's actually two different ones that are going to be put in place in 2013. The first is actually a 0.9% surtax on any income. So this is income of somebody who makes more than $250,000. And that's going to be paid, it's part of increasing the Medicare portion of your Social Security and Medicare taxes that are charged out of your income. And so instead of just paying 2.9% or actually the employee and the employer split 2.9%, anyone who makes $250,000, any income over $250,000 will have to pay an extra 0.9% on that income. And the second portion of that Affordable Care Act is actually a hit on investment income. So if anyone makes over $250,000 in investment income, and that's interest, dividends, and you know, capital gains, et cetera, anything that's above $250,000 will be charged a surtax of 3.8%. And that's going to go toward what they call the Medicare Contribution Fund, which is going to help pay for things that were passed within the Affordable Care Act.
Okay.
Okay. And then the emergency unemployment benefit, that is the expiration of unemployment extensions of unemployment benefits. It's going to go back to its original 26-week maximum. And then finally, just reduce stimulus spending. That's pretty self-explanatory in terms of they're just going to reduce the amount that they're going to be spending in terms of stimulus.
Okay. Now, we got a question on whether or not the emergency unemployment benefits were going to expire, whether they're going to be renewed or not. And the answer is, I don't know. If you look at where the economy is right now, that's one of the things that is would be most damaging to the economy not to continue those. But I think it's if you look at what the politics are right now, it's surprisingly easy for those to go one way or the other because there's so many controversial issues at hand. I didn't know, Chuck, if you had any other comments on those.
Not really. I just am concerned that this, you know, you're the expert on politics, and you can tell by Melanie speaking, she's the expert on taxes. I just expect this to be the start because we have this. From a political standpoint, there's so much uncertainty, but what we do have is uncertainty is we have a rising deficit and a budget that is completely out of control. And the only way you're going to be able to keep that at least somewhat under control is to print money and to raise taxes. And if anybody thinks that this is going to be the end of tax increases, I think that they need to reconsider that because this is going to be in our future in some form or another. This is going to continue to squeeze the working person.
We've just gotten a whole series of questions, so let me go back a little bit to the House one. Dear Catherine, rent versus buy, first home in San Francisco. My wife and I are considering the purchase of our first home in the San Francisco Bay Area. We hope to find one along with a mortgage payment, taxes, insurance that will not exceed 25% of our monthly gross income and still leave about 12 to 15% of our budget free for discretionary spending or emergencies. I work as a skilled tradesperson and do not feel very concerned about losing my job or finding work if I do. I'm having a challenging time trying to discern if renting would still be a better option if the economy tanks and unemployment goes up in 2013 like everyone expects. Thanks in advance for your thoughts. Okay, so since we've been talking about that, here's what I would say, and Chuck, you jump in after me. I think it's very important to see which way the tax provisions go and what they do to real estate in the San Francisco Bay Area. My feeling is, the economy in San Francisco is going to be relatively very strong, and housing prices will be strong there. So I would be careful to not want to get shut out of the market, but I'd love to see what happens in terms of the tax provisions and things like the alternative minimum tax and what it's going to do to your 2012 and pro forma 2013 taxes. So I would make sure you've penciled this all out before you decide on what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. So Chuck and Melanie, what would you say?
Mel, you want to go?
I think one thing that we're always talking about, especially with buying and the mortgage interest, that's something that's on the table definitely for either ratcheting down in terms of the deductibility and everything else. And so you really have to think about that in terms of whether, when you're actually doing the planning, that it may go away, it may not. So it's definitely an uncertainty that you have to figure when you're thinking about that particular purchase.
And I want to add into that it's especially important when you're on either coast, because of the cost of housing is such a dramatic portion of, people's expenses that if you make a minor mistake and it's only 10% of your income and they take away the deductibility of your mortgage expense, then it's not so bad. But if you're stretching it and you're at the limit at 25 to 30% where, you're allowed to get a loan, you make a minor mistake and they take away that deduction from you, it can mean the difference between, I have to get the heck out of my house now because I can no longer afford it. Doesn't give you a whole lot of latitude to be able to have any errors or any downside or any slowdowns in income.
Subscriber in Tucson would like you to back away from the microphone, Chuck.
Okay.
It's funny. I'm used to being on the phone with you all the time, so I'm used to being close. Another good question I should have asked in the beginning, but this is a good one. Do private practice tax preparers now, quote unquote, work for the IRS? I remember hearing you say that they are now have far more accountability. Where does an honest, hardworking taxpayer go for good advice? Can you comment?
That's if you look at the provisions related to enforcement. To me, from my point of view, the fundamental relationship between somebody preparing taxes or giving tax advice, vis-a-vis the IRS, has changed. But my attitude is it's. Obviously you want to find somebody who is trustworthy and who is competent. And my feeling is, what I always say to my tax preparer is, look, I'm not interested in pushing the line. I want to make sure I'm absolutely impeccable in terms of, how I report. And that's what you always want to be. Mel, you're an enrolled agent. So what would you add to that?
I don't actually practice in terms of helping people actually file their taxes. And in general, really, it does come down to finding someone that you can trust. And if you can find someone that you can trust and that you have a good working relationship with, then at least you have somebody that does have that knowledge base and is keeping up with the information that you may not necessarily have the time or the inclination to keep up with.
Okay, so before we go on to actions we can take, I did want to point to everyone to chart number two up on both the webinar software, and it's up on the blog if you can't access it through the webinar. What I did with our producer, Kristen Linton, is we got the tax collections from the IRS website since the mid-90s so that you could see the sort of the level of tax collections, and what you'll watch is that the collections rose in most categories as the economy sort of bubbled through 2000, and then in recent years have been coming down, and it's not too hard to look at the numbers and see sort of see what the pinch is. One thing I would note is much of the debate around the fiscal cliff is what will the individual taxes be, and the discussion has been relatively quiet on corporate taxes. And if you look at the historical collections, what I would say is, corporation share of carrying the load has been flat or dropping. And I think, and we'll talk about this in the wrap up in next year. One question is this the right way to frame it, or do corporate taxes need to be on the table too? And I, of course, would say yes. So now, Mel, let's turn to what can be done to mitigate the impact of the fiscal cliff, if anything, or any of these tax changes. So let's just start to talk through what are people's options, given what we think may happen.
Mm-hmm. Well, the main theme really is that at some point or another, tax rates, if nothing happens, are going to rise. And so if that's the case, really, you have to take advantage of lower rates before they potentially increase next year. And there's a couple of ways that you can do that. One potentially is to realize capital gains. That means, if you have built-in gains of some of your positions, it might be a good time to actually think about selling those out, because right now, if you sell them this year, by the end of this year, they'll be taxed at a maximum 15% long-term capital gains rate. And if you do it next year, it's going to go up by 5% to that 20% rate. Now, again,
right. Now, that's if it's in a regular account, not an IRA or retirement account.
Exactly. And again, I got to also remember that it doesn't necessarily that doesn't apply to the tangible assets unless a PIFIC rule applies, of course.
Okay.
Okay. Another potential thing that clients can do is actually do Roth conversions. Because Roth conversions, in this case, if it makes sense, where money's not needed immediately due to the five-year waiting period, it's a way to do that Roth conversion now. Of course, that money that you convert into a Roth is going to be taxable in this year, but at this year's rates, which are going to be lower than potentially next year's rates. And that money that you do convert into a Roth, when it becomes available for qualified distributions, it's going to be currently available to you tax-free. Of course, that could change in the future, but with current laws, it will be tax-free once it becomes a qualified distribution.
I just wanted to note, I put a link in the subscriber space in the blog post to an article you wrote or a blog post you wrote on Roth conversions. But you might just want to go over very simplistically, what is a Roth conversion?
Okay. So a Roth conversion is when you convert a traditional IRA. So that's an IRA that you have been contributing to and have been able to deduct contributions to. And that money is usually, it grows tax deferred like it does in any type of Roth. And so you haven't actually been paying any taxes on any of the gains and or dividends that have been built into that particular account. And what happens is, if you convert it, you take that money and put it into a Roth IRA. And the amount that you convert into a Roth IRA becomes taxable in the year that you do the conversion. So you pay taxes on it now, so that when you go out to take it later, it continues to grow tax deferred, but once you're able to make qualified distributions because of Roth rules, you're able to take money out of Roth IRAs on a tax-free basis. You don't pay any taxes on it at that point in time, because you paid them when you converted the IRA into a Roth.
Right.
At a lower rate.
Okay, so let's keep going.
Okay, another option is if you have two types of accounts, one a taxable account and the other some sort of tax-deferred account like an IRA, you may want to shift dividend-paying stocks into the tax-deferred account, because if nothing changes, the amount of income tax that you have to pay on dividends is going to go up to ordinary income rates from where they currently are now at 15%. So if you don't want to pay that extra tax next year, it may be a good time to, again, realize some capital gains if you have some gains on your dividend-paying stocks, and then potentially buying them back in your tax-deferred account so that when they pay your dividends in the coming years, they're going to be tax-deferred.
Okay.
And then finally, the other thing in terms of estate taxes and estate planning, when appropriate, really, this you could consider accelerating a gifting plan. And the one thing you got to remember with that, of course, is that any gift is irrevocable. And so you have to really make sure that it's appropriate for your situation.
Right. Right. That one I find is one of the trickiest to decide because you know, if you gift it to make sure you get the exemption under tax law, at the same time there are real issues about diminishing your own flexibility because it may turn out you need that money. That one can be a tricky one. I'd hate to gift everything and then wake up tomorrow and discover they hadn't dropped the exemption after all.
Yep, very true.
One more question in from Los Angeles, a real estate question. Is the mortgage interest deduction related to owner property or investment property?
It usually applies to owner property. It can be, in some cases, in terms of deduction, the mortgage interest can be deducted on investment property as well, but it's usually falling into an actual deduction based on the property itself.
Right. So it's a project deduction, not a general
yes.
deduction. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The other thing I would like to mention is that when you look at the feasibility or sort of the attractiveness of working longer hours to make more money versus doing more for yourself, I have to admit that the more taxes rise, the more attractive it is to, you know, not generate the revenues, but instead use the time to do things that significantly lower your expenses. So depending on your situation, it can really make it a lot more attractive to do things for yourself. Okay, Chuck, you had some things to add, and I know we have chart 3 that you wanted to describe, which is fascinating.
Well, the one thing I did want to make sure that one of the other topics that I think we skipped over with regards to what somebody can do to help mitigate these changes. Mel, did you mention the fact that you should be pulling in revenue into this year, if at all possible?
Oh.
So if you have the ability to recognize revenue in 2012
That's right.
rather than 2013, mm-hmm. I think that's another thing that you can do. It's kind of like, you know, taking your tax hit this year, pulling the revenue this year so it, you know, gets taxed at a lower rate.
Yes.
Right. And in fact, we had a question. Let me just read it. I'm a freelance consultant. I'm on the verge of receiving a large check for a project that I've done for a U.S. company. I could either get the payment now before the new year or after the new year. Since you forecast taxes are going to rise next year, would you recommend that I hold the payment till next year or the other way around?
Well, me, I would, you know, nobody can tell the exact situation and how this thing is going to actually play out with Congress and the president, but I would take the revenue now. That's what I'm doing personally.
Right. And some of it depends on what their other, you know.
Yes.
The other situation. Yes.
Yeah, their other situation.
Right.
See, I have the advantage that none of you all have. I have a lifetime of tax loss carry forwards. So it's a different situation. Chart 3, Chuck.
Can I just add one other thing before we jump into chart 3? Because, you know, again, this is about, for me, this is about what can be done. And part of what can be done for me is managing expectations. And, you know, I don't remember, I think you mentioned one of your listeners, I think it was about the question in housing in San Francisco, you know, they were expecting projected growth in 2013. Well, actually, what I have, you know, I went to a couple of the government websites, and their projection for growth in 2013 is 0.9%. So what I want to do is just set an expectation for what people should potentially expect if this thing goes through. So what we've done is we've quantified this and we said this potential impact, the $650 million of all of these tax increases and exemption deductions, et cetera, has an effect of approximately 4.7% of GDP. So if you take a look and if we only grow 0.9% and you have the potential of taking out 4.7%, you do the math, and that works out to be, you know, a 3.8% contraction. So what does that mean? I'm just trying to put this in context. Please don't take it like I'm predicting this, but if you use 2008, 2009 as a reference point, we had a 3.1% contraction during that period of time, and we all saw what happened to, you know, investment assets, whether they be stocks or bonds or gold, precious metals, our homes, all of those things. Now, I don't think that's going to happen. It's a completely different scenario, but we don't know what's going to play out here. And so, again, my point is to manage expectations, and that is a potential, you know, outcome as far as I'm concerned.
Right. Now, we have a series of questions on IRAs and 401ks that I want to turn to. And I've watched some of the – I know the president's proposal had had one proposal to encourage 401ks for small businesses, and we've seen that proposal floating around in various conditions. If you look at the negotiations that are going on, they're going on right now at things that generate much more immediate revenues for the budget. So I don't think IRAs or 401ks have been at the top of anybody's list in Washington. So they're, you know, they're kind of down on the list. But we have a series of questions of, one, would you start to take money out of IRAs now, or would you, you know, would you put money into IRAs given what's going on? And I'll just kick this off because I think everybody has a different opinion. But what I find is it's very unique to the individual situation. And what I try and encourage people to do is simply not have all their eggs in any basket, including the IRA basket. And certainly if you have a lot in IRA, you ought to take a look at the Roth conversion. And again, Mel did a great little piece, and it's up. You can link to it from the links in the subscriber area. I would suggest you take a look at it, but I would invite both of you to kick in because, as you know, I have a terrible prejudice on this, having said never again being slammed by the government on my 401k, but I find it's very unique to the individual. So I have a hard time always answering this question generically, but let me kick it over to each of you.
Go for it, Mel.
Well, unfortunately, I was actually going to say the same thing, which is it is going to be unique to the person's situation. And if it's, you know, the one thing you got to remember is that it is potential that you're going to taxes are going to increase. A way to try to mitigate that could be to, you know, you could either do one of two things, which is take some money out and realize that income now, or contribute more. But it is really going to be up to the individual situation.
It's very interesting at the subscribers luncheon in Murfreesboro. We got a request to do a show on self-directed IRAs, and the theory was if I use my IRA to do private venture, you know, or small business investment, it will be sufficiently illiquid that the government can't take it or mess with it, or, you know, force me to sell it and put it in an annuity. So as a lover of liquidity, it was very upsetting to hear, but the idea of putting it in something illiquid is becoming increasingly attractive. Anyway, so I thought that was an interesting, but we also got a question from somebody saying, would you suggest I put my IRA into a self-directed IRA, into something quite illiquid, because then I can not wake up and find that the Treasury has determined that it has to go into an annuity.
I have a feeling, though, Catherine, if that comes about and they really do need the money, they're going to find whatever the way that they need to make those illiquid things pretty liquid.
Right. Right.
If they need the money,
I agree.
Way.
Yep.
I agree.
But one thing I just wanted to add, and I'm not going to parrot what you guys said because you're, I think, both spot on. My only comment would be is that when people are planning for retirement, and this is an adjunct issue, the best thing you can do is to take a look at your position, and you want to go into retirement with a good balance of money between your IRA and non-IRA funds. So to answer that question, would I contribute going forward? You know, yes, all of those concerns about taxes and confiscation or whatever you want to call it. But I would also take into account that if I'm imbalanced and I have most of my assets in non-IRA funds, then I would, me personally, I can't tell everybody else what to do, but I would want to continue to contribute to my IRA. If the converse is true, I would probably forego giving up the tax deductibility and just take it, you know, pay the taxes on it and go find another home for it.
Right. Right. And that's why I think it's very unique to the individual situations. Okay. Well, Chuck, you want to just describe chart three? Because I thought it was fascinating.
Yeah, I think this is, you know, an interesting chart in the sense that, so if you look at the top line, the black line there, that's the total tax receipts as a percentage of private GDP. So that you could see that trend is, you could draw a trend line, and it's actually moving upwards. But the green line, which is a total, it's a annual revenue growth of GDP, is actually going down. So our GDP is going down, but the tax receipts from the private sector are going up. So what that's telling you is what that's saying to me is that they're squeezing, you know, more and more money is being taken away from the private sector in the form of, you know, in form of taxes.
Right. And that's what we've seen is the economy. You know, what's happened is the government's behaved in a series of ways over the last 20 years that shrinks the pie. And now it's coming back to bite them because the pie is shrinking and it's hurting their tax receipts, and now they want a bigger piece of the pie. And the reality is what we need to do is get out of that spiral, and whatever we do, we need to re-engineer in a way that makes the pie bigger. So it's not just a matter of balancing the budget, it's balancing the budget of the whole economy, not just the government. So the Sheriff of Nottingham cannot solve this problem alone. We need Robin Hood.
And Little John.
And Little John, you're right. Okay, so before we close, any other points that you would like to make?
None for me.
None for me either.
Okay, well, today is December 6th, and I think, you know, one of the things I think is if you're going to do something, it's good to do the transaction before the very end of the month. So hopefully this will give subscribers about 2 weeks to look at their own unique situation and talk to the appropriate person in your life. And if there are any transactions to be done, hopefully do it before the end of the year. So with that, Chuck and Melanie, thank you very much. You're going to, as I said, Chuck's going to be back with us for the equity overview on January 18th, and we're looking forward to that. And so Mel and Chuck, have a great evening. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you, Catherine.
Talk to you later.
Okay, our movie tonight, and I'll do this very quickly, is a 1979 American comedy drama. It's called Being There, and it's a Peter Sellers movie. I love Peter Sellers. And it's the story of a man who's lived his whole life, a middle-aged man who's lived his whole life in a townhouse taking care of the garden for an older, wealthier man who dies. And he gets forced out into the world and ends up by a series of he gets hit by a car and ends up in the home of a business mogul whose wife is played by Shirley MacLaine. And he starts talking about what he's learned from the garden, and it is misinterpreted to be profound economic insight into the economy and business and how to change policy in America. And in fact, the business mogul whose house he's staying in is a confidant of the U.S. president, who picks up on Chauncey, who rises to be a celebrity, making, you know, incredible pronouncements about the economy with his simple brand of gardening wisdom. And I thought it was a very appropriate thing to recommend to you when we're considering paying more taxes, because one of the things that's maddening about the situation is when Washington talks, they talk in what I call pretzel talk. And I remember when I first moved to Hickory Valley, after about 2 years, I said, you know, I've learned how to speak English again. And that's because, you know, there's so much going on, and there's so much hypocrisy going on, and there's so much sensitivity going on after 70 years of allocating the federal budget for political criteria instead of fundamental economics. You know, there are lies, a lot of lies that we're telling to each other and ourselves. So people in Washington are talking pretzel talk, and it's very Orwellian. And one thing that can kind of make you laugh in the middle of all of that is Being There. So check it out if you like comedy and you like Peter Sellers and you want to have a good laugh about what's going on in Washington. Okay, that's it for tonight. Thank you for joining us. We hope this was useful. Again, it's December 6th. You've got a couple weeks to look at your situation and prepare for your budget next year and take action if you think it's appropriate. Next week, a lot's been going on in the precious metals market. This should be the strong season, but precious metals has gotten hit hard. Let's see how it does for the rest of the month. So we'll be joining Franklin Sanders. I'll be over at the Top of the World Farm. And Chris Powell from GATA is going to join us, wonderful journalist, editor of a paper in Connecticut, treasurer of GATA, to talk about how the history of the press handling of precious metals. And I hope it's going to help you be a lot more astute about watching the coverage of precious metals. December 20th, we're off for Christmas, and then December 27th, the next Rappaport's called The Covert Engineering of Information. I've listened to it. It's really terrific. And remember, first week of January is our annual wrap-up. That's a very important Solari report for me, and it's sort of when I look back and see what happened in 2012 and what's important, and then look forward and say, okay, here's what informs the opportunities and risks that you're going to have to navigate in the year ahead. We do a very special transcript for that, and so that's coming up first week of January. So until next week, when I'll be back with Franklin Sanders for the Precious Metals Market Report, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.